Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
Well, good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this first hour of the show, we'll be talking about criminal trafficking in human beings. It is something that is a growing problem across the globe, damaging millions of lives. In fact, it's estimated that every year, something like 800,000 people, and most of them women and children, are bought, sold, or forced across international borders, ending up in a sort of permanent indentured servitude. This week, for the next couple of days, scholars from around the country are here on the campus of the University of Illinois to talk about this problem, criminal trafficking and slavery. It's this year's Joint Area Centers Symposium, and it's organized by the U of I Center for Global Studies. This morning here on this first hour of the show, we have one of those scholars who is here to take part in this conference. In fact, she gave the keynote address last night. Our guest is Susan Forbes Martin. She is currently the executive director of the Institute for the Study of International Migration at the Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. She is also the president-elect of the International Association for the Study of Forced Migration. She's written a lot and does a lot of talking on this issue. Her most recent publications include The Uprooted: Challenges in Managing Forced Migration, that came out last year, and the second edition of a book that she wrote that got a lot of attention, a book entitled Refugee Women. That second edition came out in 2004. Before going to Georgetown, she served from 1992 until 1997 as executive director of the U.S. Commission on Immigration Reform. And before that, she was director of research and programs at the Refugee Policy Group. That's a Washington-based center for analysis of U.S. and international refugee policy and programs. And we're pleased that she is here with us this morning on the show to talk. Questions, of course, are welcome, as always. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief so we can get in as many as possible. But anybody who is listening should feel welcome to be here and be part of the conversation. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number to call. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
I think when you start talking about this, I expect that people, that maybe some people, if they have not done reading or research in the subject, would be surprised at the extent of trafficking in human beings, and also at just how much money is involved. Because indeed, if you look at all of the various illegal enterprises around the world, things like illegal weapons trade, illegal narcotics, this, in fact, trafficking in human beings is among the top three or four illegal activities around the world. Perhaps you could start by talking a little bit about the scope of the problem.
Sure, I'd be happy to. And it's trafficking in human beings is one of those extremely difficult issues to get a handle on in terms of numbers. The numbers you used, the up to 800,000 trafficked each year, come from the U.S. State Department. They're probably the most credible statistics we have, but I think even people in the State Department and the government would acknowledge that they're really not sure if those numbers are higher or lower or just right. And you're trying to really count the uncountable because this is an underground phenomenon. We're talking about the movements of people who are in very, very severely difficult circumstances and hidden away from public view. So we really don't know just what the scope is. Plus, also, there's been a lot of attention to trafficking across international borders when they come to the U.S. or to Europe or to Thailand or to other countries. But some of the estimates are that an even larger number of people are trafficked within their own countries. And internal trafficking is sometimes even harder to get a handle on. It's harder to address because issues of sovereignty come up. And governments don't like others to interfere in their internal affairs, and they're usually unwilling to admit that this is happening. And I must admit that it happens in the U.S. There are kids who were trafficked from one part of the United States to another and end up in as prostitutes or as beggars or doing other types of illegal activities around it. But maybe I should define trafficking first, because it's a difficult concept itself. Trafficking means, first of all, recruiting and transporting people, either internally or across international borders. It has to be done by force, coercion, or deception. A lot of people are just lied to. They think they're coming for better economic opportunities, but in fact they're coming to be prostitutes or for forced labor, which is the third element of the definition, that it's for purposes of exploitation, of exploiting their labor. It's very closely related to human smuggling, but in human smuggling, the person involved is voluntarily and knowingly making a decision to move from across an international border to enter another country illegally. So trafficking is a subset, in effect, of smuggling. But it's one where the reason that we're so concerned about it is that it involves coercion, and it involves deception, and it involves exploitation. Also, a lot of the focus has been on sex trafficking, for prostitution, for pornography. But that's not the only type of exploitation that takes place. We have a lot of people who are trafficked for forced labor. They're working in agriculture and mines and fisheries, sweatshops, as domestic servants in private households. And they're also often in servitude or in slavery. They can't leave the circumstances that they're in. So it's a pretty broad topic that covers a lot of people in pretty desperate situations.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, it can be an issue where people are trafficked from one country to another, or within a country, which, as you say, makes it more difficult to track. But it seems as if one sort of constant feature is that we're talking about people who are unequal. It has to do with poor people and people who have wealth. And so that could be from a poorer country to a more wealthy country, or I suppose within a country it simply could be from a poorer place or a poorer group of people to people who have the money. It has that dynamic of wealth and poverty going for it.
Right. It has that element. Certainly people, and women in particular, who are poor, who have very little in the way of economic opportunities at home, will be more vulnerable to traffickers, who will either promise them things or will find them very difficult to. The women don't have the basis for fighting off the traffickers, and they can be easily duped into thinking that they're going to get something better for themselves and for their children. So poverty is clearly a part of the problem, and you can't get at the underlying causes of trafficking by only focusing on the criminal operations. Mm-hmm. You have to also focus on why people are vulnerable. It's also a human rights issue, that often it involves people who are very marginalized, who don't have an ability to exert rights in their own society. Again, women are very often the subjects of trafficking, and they're coming often from places where there is very little respect for their rights, where there is sex-based, gender-based discrimination against them, where they don't have access to education or employment opportunities. And so that also feeds into the vulnerability for trafficking. Mm-hmm. So that makes it for a much more complex issue to address than drug smuggling or arms smuggling might be, because the people, it's people who are involved, and you have to deal with all of the reasons that they're vulnerable.
Yeah. One thing that I think that probably we have at least seen some little bit more of attention to in recent years, and I think a part of that also comes from people who are particularly concerned with the issue, is contemporary slavery. And again, that's one of these things that I think that if you start talking about that, a lot of people will say, well, we don't have slavery now, but we do And yet its form is a little bit different. We perhaps don't have as much in the way of chattel slavery as that we used to, where one person buys and owns another, but the kind of slavery where that is more like being an indentured servant. That is, you end up being in a situation where you're committed, you maybe owe somebody something, you have to work your way out, and the situation is set up so that it's virtually impossible for you to do that.
But that's an element of it, clearly. And I think that a lot of the people who are smuggled and are volunteering to move into another country end up in such high debt that it becomes debt bondage. It does become the kind of indentured service. It takes forever for them to pay off their smuggling debts because they can be as high as $40,000-$50,000, which obviously poor people can't pay up front, so they work it off. But frankly, we do have chattel slavery. We have trafficking victims who whose passports are taken away from them, who are locked up, sometimes chained. There was a case a number of years ago in California in a town called El Monte in which a group of Thai workers were found in a sweatshop, and they were literally chained to the sewing machines, unable to leave the premises. So even in the United States, we have what looks much more like slavery than it does like servitude. Mm-hmm. And that's a part of, we see it in brothels as well, where the victims are unable to leave because of the circumstance that they're in.
Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580, Susan Forbes-Martin. She is Executive Director of the Institute for the Study of International Migration. That's at Georgetown University. And she is here to take part in a conference on the campus of the University of Illinois, a conference looking at trafficking, criminal trafficking and slavery. And that's going on here now for the next couple of days. And she gave the keynote talk last night, and we're pleased that she could be with us here in studio to talk about it. Questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I think that you and the other people at the conference want to make sure that in as much as we talk about this as a criminal enterprise and understand the dimensions there, that also one talk about the experiences of the individuals who are trafficked and what happens to them. Is there any way that you can, in a sort of a general sense, talk about a little bit more about who they are, how this happens to them, how they end up in that situation in the first place, and then what the reality of their life then afterwards is?
Sure. But it's estimated that probably about 80% of those who have been trafficked are women and children. And it largely affects people who are the most vulnerable and can be most easily exploited. They're trafficked for a variety of reasons. Sex trafficking is clearly one of the principal ways. And a lot of the criminal operations are involved in prostitution and pornography and other forms of sexual exploitation. And they make a lot of money off of it as a result of the activities. But they're also, you have kids who are trafficked to work in fisheries, diving to release fish from nets because they're small hands, camel jockeys, young kids who have been trafficked to the Gulf states and others where there are camel races. You have a lot of people who've been trafficked into forced labor and agriculture, and including in the U.S., but all over the world, it's a problem. So the people who are vulnerable to trafficking are generally coming from very, very poor areas where they have few opportunities at home, where there often is a lot of official corruption, and the law enforcement agencies in those countries can be bought off by the traffickers and then become complicit in the trafficking, facilitated, aided, allow it to happen. And so in order to deal with the prevention, we have to deal with the underlying poverty and with the lack of human rights, the lack of respect. A lot of trafficking occurs in countries in conflict, and it occurs after natural disasters because you have a lot of displacement in those situations. People have already been uprooted. They've often lost everything that they own, and therefore they become vulnerable to exploitation by others. There was a great deal of concern after the tsunami in Thailand and Sri Lanka, Indonesia, that a lot of the victims of the tsunami would be trafficked. There were efforts made immediately to try to ward that off. Victims of Hurricane Katrina are clearly at risk of trafficking because they've lost so much. So that's the human dimension of trafficking. What we can do is that the first thing is, and the, probably the most difficult thing, is identifying them because it is an underground activity. So alerting the people who might come into contact with trafficking victims that this is what's happening. And that means local police forces, that if they raid a brothel, if they arrest streetwalkers, to ask the question, you know, are these voluntarily doing it, or are they captive of someone else who's exploiting them? And same thing for labor standards enforcement. If you go into a sweatshop, go into the fields, asking the question. Hospitals, when the person comes in who's been beaten up, again, asking what's behind it, what's happened. So identification is the first thing. Then we need to have various programs in place to protect the people who've survived the trafficking. And it means that they probably need some kind of a legal status if they're staying in the U.S. or other destination countries. If they're returning home, it means that they have reintegration assistance, they have skills training, they have new employment opportunities, or else they'll just be vulnerable to being trafficked again. And so the protection is extremely important, and it's protecting their rights, but it's also protecting their economic lives so that they're not so vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. You were talking a little bit earlier about how it is and why it is that it's very difficult to come up with a number to say this many people have been victims of trafficking. If you ask a question like, through the efforts of law enforcement and government action, how many people have been rescued? Do we have a number for that? And what percent, any sort of guess about what percentage of people we actually managed to find and try to help, what percentage that might actually be of the total?
Well, there are now some programs that are in place. The United States actually has probably the best law in the world on trafficking for those who have been identified as having been trafficked into the U.S. There are programs to assist them, particularly if they're cooperating with law enforcement to try to get to the traffickers. But if they're children who've been trafficked, the first priority of these programs is to protect the children and protect their rights. But with this fantastic law, could be, of course, improved. Every law can be improved. So far in the last few years that it's been in place, out of an estimated maybe 20,000 kids per year, children who were trafficked into the U.S., only about 100, or less than 100, have actually entered this program and have been identified as being victims of trafficking and are now receiving this very, very good assistance that's available. That means we're not doing a very good job of finding the others.
We have some callers here. We'll bring them into the conversation. The number here, by the way, is 333-9455. That's our local number. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. We'll start in with Bloomington, Indiana, and our line four. Hello.
Hello. You mentioned government corruption, police corruption. It seems to me trafficking people for prostitution should be very easy to stop if there's not corruption, because it should be so easy to detect. If prostitutes are trafficked, if they're trafficking victims, then their presence in a brothel has to be publicized in order to get customers. In order to get customers for prostitution, the brothels have to be easy to find. If the customers can find the brothels, why can't the police find them? And it seems to me, certainly they can. Public television, I believe it was Frontline, did a documentary on this trafficking, and they very easily showed a whole street. The establishments were there, and the women were actually displayed, and they didn't have any trouble at all panning their their camera down the street showing one brothel after the other for the customers, I guess, but somehow the police didn't know it was there. And they also reported that even when they would get one of these brothels shut down, it only stayed shut down for a few days. A few days later, it was back in business. Well, that's got to be government corruption and police corruption. So the problem, the problem is more than trafficking. The problem is basically government corruption, isn't it?
Well, that's clearly a major part of the problem, and throughout the world that the corruption of officials, not just police, but judges and others, is a problem. But it goes deeper than that. Even where the corruption isn't a problem, you can end up having trafficking victims falling through the cracks. Breaking up prostitution is often not considered a high priority compared to other forms of crime that appears to. It's often thought about as a victimless crime because the assumption is that the prostitutes are volunteering to be prostitutes. And it's really only trafficking which has then becomes an issue of coercion. But I'll give you an example of how difficult it can be to identify the victims. There was one of the cases which actually did work, and the children were identified. It's a case in New Jersey in which the police did break up a brothel. The prostitutes were brought before a court, and the judge had asked a number of questions and particularly was trying to get at whether there were any minors, any children amongst the prostitutes, and they were all represented by an attorney who told the judge, everyone is over the age of 21, and they're prepared to pay the penalties, fines, whatever, probably short prison term was necessary. And the judge, though, looked at about half a dozen or so of the prostitutes and just didn't agree that they looked as if they were over 21. And so he asked the lawyer who was paying his fees, and the lawyer wouldn't answer the question because pretty obviously it was the brothel that was paying his fees. So the judge assigned another attorney to the case. After a number of days of discussions with them, they found out that these were children who had been told that they should always say that they were 21 years old if the police came. And this was one heroic judge who refused to accept the easy out. But how often in our court system does this happen? How often do the police really press and engage in order to be able to determine whether or not these are trafficking victims and not other, and not just people who are volunteering to commit a criminal act?
Well, you know, what you're saying is, it seems to me that the corruption goes deep. The corruption goes even into the courts, and that doesn't surprise me. I think maybe one of the root causes of the corruption may be a cultural acceptance of prostitution. There are some countries now, and they consider themselves quite progressive, that have legalized prostitution, and even some of the reporters on NPR will call, and they won't call prostitutes anymore. They call them sex workers in order to make their occupations seem more acceptable. And the idea is that prostitution is becoming culturally acceptable, and so that encourages the government corruption not to stop it.
Well, without trying to get into a debate on prostitution, which I think in many respects doesn't help get too far along in terms of the discussion of trafficking. Whether you agree with whether prostitution should be legal or illegal, I don't think anyone would agree that women and children should be forced into prostitution. And that's what the problem is with trafficking, is that these are people who have been either deceived into it or forced into it and who have no options, no ability to leave the circumstance that they're in. And that's the real nature of trafficking. And it doesn't matter about the legality or illegality of the prostitution. The trafficking in and of itself is illegal. And it doesn't matter if it's for prostitution or if it's for domestic servitude or if it's for agriculture or if it's for sweatshops or any other form. If it's exploitive, it's forced, it's coerced, it's trafficking, and it's bad. Mm-hmm.
I hope the caller won't mind if I say thanks for the comments and go on, because I have several other people who are holding and we're already a little bit past the midpoint. And I should probably also reintroduce our guest, Susan Forbes-Martin. She's executive director of the Institute for the Study of International Migration at the Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service, which is at Georgetown University. She's also president-elect of the International Association for the Study of Forced Migration. Before taking up her post at Georgetown in 1998, she served from 1992 until 1997 as the executive director of the U.S. Commission on Immigration Reform. And before that, she was director of research and programs at the Refugee Policy Group. That's a Washington-based center for analysis of U.S. and international refugee policy and programs. She is here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois to take part in a conference. Scholars from all over the country are here for a conference talking about criminal trafficking and slavery. It's sponsored by, organized by the U of I Center for Global Studies. Questions are certainly welcome, and we have several other people who are waiting. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Next up is someone in Champaign County, and that's line one. Hello.
Hi. I'm glad you're taking this more systemic point of view on it, because it seems to me that when we have this condition in the world where the most income a lot of lesser developed countries get is their remittances from abroad, that it adds to the complexity, and one wonders if there's some complicity and winking at it going on. You mentioned the Gulf states, and they've been notorious for the longest time having East Asian and Filipino women come in as maids, but also whatever else was the pleasure of the sheik or emir or whomever. So I really think that, you know, without bashing and being stereotypical, most people in the Gulf states can't do that, but there has been a long historic tradition of that. One of the other bullet points I have here is there was an expose, I don't know if you're familiar with this, in the Chicago Tribune, and it wasn't picked up much in the newspapers of record like the Post or the New York Times, but there was an enterprise called Moonlight Limited, I guess, that was recruiting people in subcontinental India, Asia, and there was this notorious beheading of Nepalese workers that was directly related to that in Iraq, where Nepalese workers were told they were going to work in a 5-star hotel in Amman, Jordan, and they ended up working for some subcontractors in Iraq, and were not able to leave, wanted to leave desperately, were in the position of, you know, having already accepted money for their families, for their positions there, and these nine Nepalese were eventually beheaded in one of those gory early beheadings of any outside workers that were coming into Iraq. So this is a company that still, I understand, is still working, and it's still supplying workers from East Asia, other areas, to Iraq. I don't know if you've followed that story particularly. It was quite well done.
Yeah, I didn't follow that particular story, but what you're describing doesn't surprise me, that this type of trafficking does occur with some regularity into very unstable countries, but where there's a lot of high level of investment and a lot of resources, it's a perfect environment for trafficking to flourish, because the rule of law is not in place. Corruption can flourish. There aren't standards. There aren't functioning governments that can protect people, and so the circumstances for trafficking are perfect in places like Iraq during this period. So it doesn't surprise me at all. And in fact, one of the areas that I'm particularly concerned about, since I work not only on trafficking but also on other forms of displacement during conflict, I'm particularly concerned about places that are in the midst of conflict or in the immediate post-conflict period, because there's so much greater vulnerability in those countries. And very often the people who are brought in to help the population to recover end up becoming a part of the problem when you're dealing with trafficking. This has been particularly the case in terms of peacekeepers. There was a burgeoning of prostitutions and brothels in Bosnia, for example, with the peacekeeping NATO troops coming in. And it's somewhat understandable. You have a lot of 18 to 25-year-old young men separated from their families. But when that occurs and the peacekeepers are themselves the problem, then it becomes extremely hard to suppress trafficking because, in fact, the trafficking is going to fulfill their needs, and they're the customers. They're the demand side of the problem.
This general idea of the importance of remittances and the sort of systemic problem you've sort of pointed at, I don't know if you have any more to say about that, whether there's whether there's any witting in action, or we've already talked about low level police corruption being involved, but what about the idea that these overseas remittances are so important for the? I've heard an academic who actually was used to be here in the U of I talking about the export of resources. So yeah. It was rather shocking to hear it. I'll hang up and listen on the air. Thanks.
Okay.
Thanks. There's a lot of overlap between regular forms of migration, both legal and illegal, and smuggling and trafficking. And trafficking sometimes is able to occur in contexts in which there is a lot of other types of migration taking place. Remittances, that's the money that migrant workers send back to their home countries, has become an increasingly important part of the migration scene. It's estimated, the World Bank estimates, that it's as much as $200 billion per year of remittances that are coming back into generally poor developing countries. Compared to, for example, official development assistance, what taxpayers provide, that averages about $60 billion a year. So migrants are sending back about three times as much money to developing countries as the wealthy countries do through their official programs. What that means is that a lot of countries are highly dependent on those migrant transfers. They want to keep the doors open in order for migrants to be able to go earn the money and send it back home. And that's an environment in which people who want to set up smuggling operations and trafficking operations can find a ready supply of fairly desperate people who want to get to someplace better in order to earn money and send it back to support their families. But having been trafficked, they're often not in a situation where that's the end positive benefit of their migration. They just end up being exploited themselves.
Well, I have some other callers here. We'll go next to someone in Champaign. This would be line number two. Hello.
Hello. I'm calling to see if there's any truth to what I read recently in a book by Al Franken, The Truth with Jokes. And he highlighted or contended that a prominent political figure, namely Tom DeLay, and also now Jack Abramoff, were involved in some type of human trafficking enterprise, and I believe the Mariana Islands, involving people from China and maybe other parts of Asia or Southeast Asia. Is there any truth to that, to your knowledge?
Yeah, I can't comment on the extent to which Tom DeLay and Jack Abramoff were complicit, but I can comment actually on what was going on in the Northern Marianas, because I, during the 1990s, I did do a site visit there on behalf of the Commission on Immigration Reform in order to investigate it. For listeners who aren't familiar with the Marianas, it's a Commonwealth territory of the United States. It has its own immigration laws though it operates, it makes its own decisions about who can come into the country and who can't, having had that authority granted to it from the U.S. Congress. And they have built an economy largely based on exports to the mainland United States of clothing and textile manufacturing, and had at the time, at least that I did the site visit, imported a very, very large number of Chinese workers into the island. They were living in pretty bad conditions, were working under contracts that were highly restrictive in terms of their rights. There were also a lot of sex tourism to the Marianas, mostly from Japan, and women who had been recruited as hostesses, but who were really forced into prostitution. It was a major problem, but the every effort during that period to change the laws in order to gain more control over it were blocked in Congress, and largely by members who felt that the Marianas should be able to operate their own economy, set their own minimum wage, and do their own enforcement. And it was, and I believe remains, a problem in terms of having a part of the United States that can produce items that actually say made in the United States, operating under very, very different laws and very different standards than operate in the rest of our country.
Are you familiar that even though Tom DeLay may not have been directly complicit, and I believe Franken made the allegation also that he used his considerable power at the time as House Minority Leader to make sure the laws were not changed for the benefit of those forced laborers? Are you familiar with that type of slant on this issue?
Well, certainly there were public statements at the time coming out of the congressional leadership praising the Northern Marianas for their free market economy, and without commenting on exactly who was responsible, there were also negotiations taking place at that point about opening a casino in the Marianas, and so it was a very complex, very difficult circumstance to be working in. I don't want to point fingers at it. And I don't know exactly who was involved in terms of the final decision-making, but it certainly was not a pretty sight and did not rebound very well to the United States.
All right, thank you.
All right, let's go on to line number three. This is someone in Urbana. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I've got a couple of comments and a question. The first couple of comments would be that there was a really pretty amazing story on ABC News earlier this month about international sex trafficking and being a well-known problem, but they were highlighting it happening here in the United States. And one of their little factoids was that the FBI estimated that well over 100,000 children and young women are trafficked in America today, and that they range in age from 9 to 19, with the average being about 11, unquote. That was on ABC News. And one of the main points of that news magazine article was that they claimed, and this kind of, I'm kind of agreeing with the very first caller you had. They claimed in this article that the internet was making it, quote, almost impossible for the police to track these girls down, unquote, because they kept the girls off the street and they only operated on the internet. Well, I'm afraid I agree with the first caller. I just don't see how that, if the potential customers can find them, I don't see why the police can't. But I wanted to keep those in the area of comments. I have a question, and that is that I understand that that in some ways Britain has kind of, and in terms of the legal situation, has already been confronted with this. I know that the Independent had a article entitled Britain's Shameless Role in Helping Sex Traffickers Keep Thousands of Women in Slavery. And that the idea was that the government failed to combat, quote, an evil trade in human misery by refusing to grant women rescued from trafficking the right to stay in Britain long enough to recover from their ordeal. And that made me think that, I'm wondering whether or not Britain managed to find some way of handling this legally, and B, I'm guessing that it would be even stickier here in the U.S. since we're so terrified of terrorists and those kind of problems. So I thought I'd ask those questions and see what you might answer, and I'll hang up. Thank you.
Okay. The U.S. actually has a legislation which is considered a model for the rest of the world. It could be better, but it has a lot of very good components to it. And under the Trafficking Victims Protection Act and its various reauthorizations that have taken place, if somebody is a victim of a severe form of trafficking, there is a potential for providing them with permanent status or temporary status initially and then permanent legal status in the United States. For adults, they do have to cooperate with law enforcement agencies in testifying or cooperating and trying to get at the trafficking rings. For children, it's more of a blanket grant of legal status. And our legislation is quite good in recognizing that families left behind may also be endangered by the traffickers, particularly if there's testimony against them. So it even allows the U.S. In these cases to bring the family members to the U.S. so that they can be protected. This is something which more and more governments are looking at. I don't know the particular British policies, but a number of the European Union countries are adopting similar legislation. The other side of it is that sometimes the people who have been trafficked really do want to go home. They don't want to stay where they've been exploited. They want to reunify with their families back home. But they need assistance, because if they're just deported, go back in exactly the same situation that they've been in, they're still vulnerable to further exploitation. More and more, the U.S. Agency for International Development in the U.S., other international development agencies are starting to develop more programs for reintegration of trafficking victims with protections, with assistance, with skills training, help for finding new jobs, developing new industries. And that's really is the model that we have to have, where we consider not just the traffickers and their prosecution, which is extremely important, but we also consider the future of the trafficking victims and help them survive and prosper after the experiences that they've had.
We have about 7-8 minutes left in this part of Focus. We have another caller we'll get right to. I just do, for others who might have tuned in, want to introduce again the guest, Susan Forbes Martin. She's the executive director of the Institute for the Study of International Migration at Georgetown University. That's part of the Edmund Walsh School of Foreign Service. And she is here visiting the campus, one of a number of scholars from around the country, here to take part in a conference discussing criminal trafficking and slavery, organized by the U of I Center for Global Studies. Questions are welcome. We'll try to get in as many as we can in the time that remains. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll free 800-222-9455. And the next caller here is in Urbana, line 1. Hello.
Hi there. Yes, I was curious, where per capita is the best place in the world and where's the worst place in the world?
Gosh, I wish I could answer that. I honestly don't know that I could do that kind of a rank ordering. I can tell you what are some of the regions where the problem is the greatest. I would say probably if I had to identify one region, it would be Southeast Asia, and probably the biggest maybe I can answer your question in terms of the worst place. I think probably Burma, Myanmar would rank pretty highly as a worst-case example. And there, that's because there's every type of trafficking you can imagine coming out of Burma. There's sex trafficking into Thailand and other countries in Southeast Asia, but there's also forced labor within Burma of people who are just basically captured by the military junta and put to work, all sorts of road works and other things, enslaved for that purpose. And there are child soldiers, which is another form of trafficking, where children are forced into, again, exploited as soldiers working with one side or another of the conflict, and all sides of the conflict in Burma have recruited children in this way. And the children aren't just fighting, but they're also, boys are recruited to fight. Some girls are to fight, but also a lot of girls are recruited in order to service sexually and otherwise as cooks and cleaners, the troops. So Burma, I'd say, probably, deserves to be at the very, very bottom of the rank in terms of being a worst-case scenario. And the U.S. actually has three tiers for trafficking of countries. Tier 3 are the worst offenders, and Burma is, and North Korea are in that category of places. Best places, that's really hard to say because this, although it's not a new phenomenon, we've had trafficking, we used to call it white slavery, years ago, for many, many years. There's new attention to it. There's now an international protocol that has gone into force with very, very rapid ratification by a lot of countries. There's new attention to the issue, and a lot of countries are just starting to ratchet up their programs and their policies. A lot of places, trafficking was not even a criminal offense. Still remains the problem today. So I don't think there's any place that I could immediately say that's the best place in terms of dealing with trafficking, but a lot of countries are now trying a lot harder than they used to.
And would you say the United States is a proactive and perhaps a better place than others?
Yes, definitely. And one of the reasons is that this is an issue that has attracted a right-left coalition. And so there's a lot of political support for a very proactive policy with regard to human trafficking. On the right, a lot of religious conservatives, evangelical groups are extremely concerned, particularly with the sex exploitation, but with all forms of exploitation. On the left, there are human rights groups, immigrant advocacy groups, also more leftist religious groups that are equally concerned about exploitation, about the human rights violations. And so in the U.S., we've been able to develop a very, very strong coalition of political support to be able to put in place quite good legislation and a willingness to expend financial and human resources in order to tackle trafficking. So it's one of those unique areas where the right and the left can fully agree that trafficking is bad and we as a country need to do something about it.
All right. Thank you for your time.
Thanks. And certainly with something like this, a problem that is a global problem, you would think that the most effective approach would be, or a more effective approach would be, is if all countries could get together and agree. First of all sit down and say, all right, this is a problem. Then we need to do something about it and have a kind of a unified or at least consistent effort so that the law from one place to another is basically going to be the same.
Yeah. And in fact, that's exactly what's happening. There is a UN Convention on Transnational Organized Crime that binds countries together to fight that phenomenon. There's a protocol to the convention that deals specifically with human trafficking. It requires extensive interstate cooperation in battling trafficking and provides very good guidance on protection and prevention of trafficking. I wish those provisions were more binding on countries, but they do provide a good framework for protection. And it's been probably the most rapidly ratified treaty that I can think of at the international level. And it's gone into force. It has some teeth in it in terms of sanctions against countries that that don't fulfill their commitments. And we're moving in the way towards very, very good international cooperation in dealing with this problem. Main issue for now, though, is now that we're starting to get common agreements on definitions and policies and legislation, is implementation. Mm-hmm. And that's where it's going to count, whether the implementation takes place at the ground level where the problems are really arising.
Yeah, it's something that now we can see is starting to get some more attention in media. Governments are paying attention to it. Law enforcement is paying attention to it. I just want to for a minute come to this conference that's going on here and whether you think that this is something that in the past maybe hasn't gotten quite as much attention as perhaps it should from the academic community, and that by further study of the problem, they can also contribute to the effort of getting a better understanding of what the problem is, the scope of the problem, and then that helping to channel into the effort to do something about it.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right that the academic community is, as with everyone else, is now just getting engaged in it. What's exciting about this conference is that it is taking a systemic approach to it. It's bringing together people who look at the issue from a criminal justice point of view, people who look at it from a migration point of view, from a human rights point of view, from a development point of view. We don't often talk to each other and exchange our points of view. It's also bringing area experts because trafficking is a global problem, but it manifests itself differently in different regions. And so the conference, I think, is fantastic. And the fact that it's taking place in the American heartland is also very good. We've got to get the discussion out of the capitals and into local communities and in a way in which radio shows of this type can get the word out, help people understand the nature of the problem. Because every time we buy cheap consumer goods, cheap vegetables, we may be, in fact, contributing to trafficking mm-hmm. without really thinking about the implications of our own actions.
Well, we will have to stop there. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Susan Forbes Martin is the Executive Director of the Institute for the Study of International Migration and the Edmund Walsh School of Foreign Service, Georgetown University.